Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. Before we go to talk about Mount Auburn Cemetery with our guests in the studio, I want to play for you a remembrance we recorded today for Tupac Shakur. They just can't stand them. Today is the birthday of a man who's had a profound effect on the cultural life of our country and of the world, Tupac Shakur. He would have been 38 years old today if his life had not been cut short. I remember Tupac as a skinny 15-year-old kid in my class at Baltimore School for the Arts. I remember his brilliance, his incredible innate natural acting ability in my scene study class. I remember a gentle young man with an amazing sense of humor. I remember him as a clown. No, not in the negative sense, but as a very funny guy who always kept folks a little off base and laughing, with a quick mind for every turn of phrase, for every little thing that someone did or said. I also remember a young man with a deep, deep social consciousness. His mother was a real revolutionary. She'd been one of the Harlem Panther 21, facing prison in a conspiracy trial in New York. His godfather was Geronimo Pratt, who served time in prison in L.A. for crimes he didn't commit as a Black Panther. His stepdad was part of the Brinks armed robbery, where two police officers died. It was a revolutionary time, with the tail end of it. Belief in social justice and ending racism and the liberation of Black people and all people were part of his genetic life source. I remember that young man as if it were yesterday. I never saw him again after he turned 18, but my daughter Piper kept up with him in L.A. and beyond. So beyond his fame, I always kept up with his world. It was funny. He was so far from the thug life, from the thug image when I knew him. He was just a kid, a funny kid, a smart kid. A kid with a beautiful heart and soul. He became his own image, or the image that the rap industry wanted him to have. He embraced it wholeheartedly, or at least he seemed to embrace it. The street was in his soul. Being tough was in his soul. It was part of his world and his family. But so was being gentle and sensitive. His music, his poetry, not only influenced a genre of our culture, but the consciousness of generations to come. Only knew what he left behind. His music was joyous at times. He was filled for love with Black people, for liberation. As Michael Dyson, the scholar and author of a book on Tupac and the host of the Michael Eric Dyson Show said, he spoke with a brilliant insight as someone who bears witness to the pain of those who would never have his platform. He told the truth, even as he struggled with the fragments of his own identity. That was true in his words, his music, and his life. I love something he once said. He said, we wouldn't ask why a rose that grew from the concrete is having damaged petals. In turn, we would celebrate its tenacity. We'd all love its will to reach the sun. But we are the roses. This is the concrete. And these are my damaged petals. Don't ask me why. Thank God. Ask me how. Tupac Shakur did change the world. His image sits in homes, from an Indian kid on a res in Wyoming to a boy sitting in a hut in Kathmandu, the house of a hip-hop artist on Gay Street in East Baltimore, the penthouse of a rebellious young white boy. Tupac's spirit is everywhere. He left us with thoughts and dreams and ideas. I remember Tupac Shakur like it was yesterday. A funny, gentle young boy with a lot to say and share with this world. Happy birthday, Tupac. So they all know me, the lyrical lunatic, the maniac AC. I give a shout out to your home. And maybe then the critics will leave your boy alone. G on the streets or on TV. It just don't pay to be a truth telling MC. They won't be happy till I'm banned. The most dangerous weapon. An educated black man to point blank in your face. Pump up the bass and join the human race. I throw peace to the back. Cause from the jungle to Old Town, they're backing me up all the way. You know you gotta love the sound. It's from the rebel of the underground. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and African-American culture is part of the root and soul of this nation and is vitally important to all of our futures, which is why this hour we're going to talk about a very amazing movement taking place right here in Baltimore to save Mount Auburn Cemetery, to rebuild it and maintain it. It is the oldest African-American-owned cemetery in Baltimore, having been founded in 1868, and we are joined in studio now by an old friend of mine, Reverend Douglas Sands, Board of Directors of the Mount Auburn Cemetery. I've known Doug forever. Good to have you in the studio.
It's good to be here
with you,
Mark.
Always a pleasure to see you. Dr. Deborah Newman Ham, History Professor at Morgan State University.
Hello.
Is with us. Good to have you in the studio. Mm-hmm. Diane Jones, Assistant Professor in the Department of Landscape Architecture at Morgan State University. Good to have you here. And I can say it's one of the best landscape architecture programs anywhere in the country, right here at Morgan State University.
It really is.
It really is. Why don't you slide a little closer to that mic there. Aaron Bryan is with us, curator of the James E. Lewis Museum of Art here on campus as well. James, good to see you again.
Yeah, nice seeing you again.
Robin Howard is with us, who is the social director. Do I have that right?
Associate director.
Associate director. I wrote too quickly. Associate director of the Center for Museums and Historic Preservation here at Morgan State University as well. Good, lovely to have you here.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
So let's talk about this. I think that we think of cemeteries as places where, you know, they're always maintained and that where our ancestors and families are buried. But there is a real struggle in this community and in this country to preserve and save African-American cemeteries. So who wants to talk? Why don't you start about the story of what's going on here with Mount Auburn?
Well, part of it is the way in which the concept of the African-American cemetery has developed. It did not develop with a notion for perpetual care. It developed as community properties, and in the shift of time and how things have changed, our communities move about now. And people who in previous generations took care of burial spots no longer live in the same communities as the burial spots for their ancestors. That's the main reason why. I think we call it nowadays something like perpetual care.
Right.
But African-American cemeteries were not created with that in mind.
And this was a cemetery that was created post-slavery. 1868?
Yes.
So, I don't know who to begin with. Why don't you tell us how you all are participating in this and why Morgan State University is in the middle of this from all these different corners of the college. Why don't you start, Robin Howard?
It started with a very small workshop one day about 3 years ago. The museum had a workshop, and the workshop was about Mount Auburn Cemetery. And from that... this grew. It just happened that we started a partnership, we started a relationship with Sharp Street Church and the cemetery, the Center for Museums, the School of Architecture. The students in the School of Architecture used the cemetery as their workshop, as their drawing board. They were able to go out to the cemetery and they were able to do things for their course. For their course of study in the landscape and in planning courses, they were able to do these things for their classes. But it was a win-win situation because the cemetery was able to get something out of it, and the students as well. And it just developed. They did a great presentation in front of the president, President Richardson, and it was really nice. So basically, from that, the ball just kept rolling, and it's gotten bigger and bigger, and it's been a really good ride for all of us.
Obviously, this makes a great deal of sense that. Dr. Newman Ham is here because, I mean, history has everything to do with this project.
History has everything to do with it. And I also have worked as an archivist. So
I'm just going to get a little closer to the mic. I'm sorry.
So the...
There you go. Great. Thank you.
There are a number of records about the people at the cemetery. And the records need to be cared for and perhaps digitized and... made available to both historians and genealogists. So I worked at the National Archives, where it's the center for genealogy in the country for federal records, and at the Library of Congress. Then coming here to work with the students, we've been involved in many, many archival projects. So this is a very, very interesting and useful one, and hopefully we can produce some kind of good permanent finding aid so that we really have intellectual control. Who is in the cemetery? Where are they? And then we've created a good genealogical and historical research.
Did I read correctly there could be 40,000 people buried in that cemetery?
Yes.
40,000 people?
Yes.
43,000 plus.
So I'm not being facetious or impolite, but what do you put 43,000 people in a cemetery that size? Where are they?
It's 33 acres.
It's 33 acres?
Yes.
Okay. I didn't realize it was that big. That's a big cemetery. 43,000 people. And how many of these graves do we know? I mean, how many of these places, I mean, do we know where they are or who's in them? Or?
A lot of the grave sites, some of the grave sites are massive grave sites as mass burials. The cemetery was used during the time of the plague in Baltimore for burials. There are other burials that have taken place there without persons being identified as a result of the wars that we've experienced. And so it is a burial. There are certain areas where we know that there are mass burials, and we have an idea of the number that are there. And at the same time, the erosion that has taken place there has meant that some of the monuments that were there have shifted. And so we do have to have a different activity to identify where everybody is. We're undertaking that. Morgan is helping us with that as well, to identify who is who and where they are.
Diane Jones, I'm just thinking about this as... This has been described to me, and I have not been, have not set foot at Mount Auburn for a long, long time, but have been to the cemetery. And the idea of, I guess, the landscape of what you're doing is kind of almost recreating that moment, recreating that place. I mean, what's your approach to what you're doing there?
Well, the cemetery is a unique landscape because the African-American cemetery is quite different in design from the European cemetery.
How so?
Because of African-American culture, it's more improvise, not just because of the fact that there was in perpetual care, but when people come there, when families came there, they actually kind of carried on ceremonies and did different things. There's actually a plot there, the Holsey plot, where you can see where people wrap the monument and they hung jugs, and there are all kinds of examples of that.
It's
and
a Holsey, the name of a family?
The Holseys is the name of the family.
H-O-S-E-Y?
H-O-L-S-E-Y.
The Holseys, okay.
Yeah. And a lot of that came out of... slavery and African Americans' relationship to the land was, you know, quite different. It's kind of, you know, ephemeral, and you might be there, you might not. So the cemetery is more of a place of ritual as opposed to a place of monument, mm-hmm. you know, being monumental and, you know, showing, you know, how much you had. It was more the ritual of communing with, you know, the dead. So a lot of that, even though the cemetery... Mount Auburn actually is kind of the rural cemetery layout. This kind of improvisation happened on top of it. And that's really unique. It makes it what you call a cultural landscape. So we're really interested in, of course, you know, finding out where all the burials are and making it so people can come, but also retaining that special landscape.
Well, I have to ask you this question. So what was the significance of the jugs? What did that mean?
The spirits, like it's water. It's probably like this particular grave has some African writing on it. So it's probably a certain religious or cultural ritual.
Right. Yeah, I was going to say.
Also, Aaron Bryan, curator of the museum here. Yeah. I'm sorry, Aaron, go ahead.
And also, this, particularly with the Holsey site, we do know that the family was from South Carolina, and there were particular cultures in South Carolina, particularly the Gullah people,
right.
who maintained some of their cultural retentions and connections to Africa. They continued to practice some of the same rituals. So the writing that's actually on the Holsey site is actually Yoruba writing, which would be practiced by the Gullah people who were also from South Carolina. And also with Gullah sites, in particular, they still practice some of these rituals of you'll see broken plates, for example, on the gravesite. You will see the gravesite or a tree next to it wrapped with cloth, and you'll see these jugs. And there can be different meanings for the jugs. And we can have different ideas for the jugs. Some people say it's just water for, you know, for that travel across to the other side or whatever. But I'm thinking that the connection is more than likely this South Carolina and African retention that goes through, you know, those slaves.
And the particular site, the Halsey site, this, I guess, must be one of the older sites in the cemetery, or no?
I would say it might be one of the, well, there are three. There's a monument that, the monument that there, the particular one with the shroud wrapped around it appears to be much older, but then there, beside that, there's, I think, the husband, a husband and a wife, that those sites look to be much later.
Yeah, because this ritual actually has been taking place, you know, recently. I mean, we were actually able to talk to one of the Holseys.
Really?
Yes.
That's shocking. So, they live in South Carolina still.
The Holsey we talked to was here. That shows that the specialness of this place and this kind of activity is still happening here.
Join us here at 410-319-8888. We're talking about Mount Auburn Cemetery, a burial ground in Baltimore that was founded in 1868 by the Sharp Street Methodist Episcopal Church, or at least it's associated with the church. I'll learn more myself in just a moment here from our guests. And the effort to save the cemetery, to restore the cemetery, to tell its history, to make it a central part of our culture in this community. We are joined by Robin Howard, who is the Associate Director of the Center for Museums and Historic Preservation here at Morgan State University, who first wrote us about this program. Aaron Bryan, who's Curator of the James E. Lewis Museum of Art here on campus. Is it Dr. Diane Jones?
No,
just Diane Jones.
Yes.
Who could be? I'll make you one anyway. Assistant Professor in the Department of Landscape Architecture at Morgan State University, Dr. Deborah Newman Hamm, who is a history professor at Morgan State University, and the Reverend Doug Sands, a veteran civil rights worker, member of the Board of Directors of Mount Auburn Cemetery. 410-319-8888 is the number here to join us in this conversation. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. 410-319-8888. Maybe you have family in that burial ground. Maybe you are associated in some way with that, and just think about it. You have conversations about it. It's in the lore of this city. 410-319-8888. I was reading about the people who were buried there that we know of. Lily Carol Jackson, mm-hmm. the great civil rights activist. William Ashby Hawkins, the first black person to run for U.S. Senate here in Maryland. John Henry Humphrey, founder of the African American newspapers.
I meant Murphy.
And Joseph Gaines, I had no idea, who was a light heavyweight champion in like 1900 or 1901. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so that's just the tip of the iceberg.
Mm-hmm. There are many more, and there are others who are closely related to Morgan State University, I would suppose. The first woman to graduate from Morgan State Morgan College in those days. And matter of fact, back in those days, it was the beginning of women attending Morgan. And she's buried there, Sarah Carr. She became Mrs. Reverend Love's wife, Reverend Julius Love's wife, and Bishop Edgar A. Love's mother, first woman to graduate from Morgan.
So now, tell us what the plans are. What's going on at the moment? I mean, the difficulties and also the plans about reviving, saving, and growing this.
Well, the plans
Diane
are
Jones.
The plans are multiple. They're on many levels because it's such a big undertaking. So there's the restoration, you know, physical writing of the graves and discovering where they all are. There's, you know, getting the archive and the records together. There happens to be several acres that don't have, not a lot, but about 4 acres, I guess, that don't have any burials on them.
Uh-huh.
So the development of a new visitor center and school and maintenance facility, and that's actually part of what my class worked on. They did a master plan for that. And then there's also the development of a management and business plan. And like the great thing is that for Morgan is that we were able to have a lot of different schools and departments work on this, not just architecture, but
business.
Yeah,
I can imagine it's really cross-disciplinary,
this whole thing.
Yeah, and it's been, as I said before, it's been a win-win situation because the students were able to use the cemetery as their classroom, and they were able to physically do work that they couldn't have done anywhere else. You know, how many students get that opportunity to just go and, you know, spend some time there and doing that kind of work other than trying to research it, you know, maybe doing something over the internet. So it really was a win-win for the cemetery, for the church, you know, and for the students.
So what is the ultimate goal here? I mean, it seems like this could be a huge project costing a huge amount of money.
Yes, it is a huge project. And our ultimate goal is to bring it back to life and fix it so that it stays that way. We have in addition to what Morgan has done, which already would have cost millions of dollars. I mean, they gave us six, I believe, complete plans, each with its own integrity of what to do with that cemetery. And we had several meetings of the board to come out with one, which also is going to be expensive. But we're not soliciting funds. I want to put that on the table, right? Nobody's soliciting funds for the cemetery right now, because we must find out what all of this is going to cost. And we'll be in the phase of doing that soon.
We're in the planning stage at the moment.
Yes. But it also means that what we're doing right now also is restoring the cemetery. Now, the State Department of Public Safety and Correctional Services has a crew which works there every day. And they have done a great job of removing the debris and all of the overgrowth that was shielding the cemetery from view. And they continue to work there. So that's part of what is being done.
Let me open the phones. Folks, may I just put your headphones on so you can hear the callers who are calling in to join us. We're talking about Mount Auburn Cemetery, the oldest privately owned African-American cemetery in Baltimore. Is there an older one in Baltimore than the Mount Auburn? Is the oldest one, is it not?
Yes,
the oldest one.
Yeah. 410-319-8888. Liz in Edgemere, you're on the air.
Hi. I think this is a great conversation and great topic to have. I'm just curious, we've talked a lot about the cemetery, but we haven't talked about where it is.
Oh, that's a great question.
Exact location, and can people, is it the public land? Can people just, you know, come and see it? Just a little bit of the orientation of where it is.
That's a great question. I'm glad you asked that. I appreciate you being.
It's in Westport, Mount Winans, so like right off of 295 Annapolis Road. It actually overlooks the Baltimore Harbor, and that's one of the greatest things, I think, one of the greatest things about it is that it's a great piece of green space right in the middle of the city. So part of this restoration is also part of preserving the environment. And I'm sure that... Well, we're having a program there on the 20th.
Tell us about the program.
So people can come. You want
to? Well, the program, it's a living history program, and theater students
I want to hear about
from
this.
Morgan.
What are they going to do?
We have five theater students that are going to bring to life some of the folks in the cemetery.
That's a Saturday,
it's
right?
It's this Saturday. Saturday at 3 o'clock in the cemetery. So the performance is
what are they
going
to do?
So they're going to become some of the folks from the cemetery that
are
buried in the cemetery.
What are they going
to
do?
They're going to bring them to life. Do you want to know who they're going to do?
Yeah.
Okay, they're going to do Carl Murphy.
Uh-huh.
They're going to do Lily Cal Jackson,
mm-hmm.
Joe Gaines.
Mm-hmm.
And then two that we thought were really intriguing, Mr. Halsey.
Oh, they're
going
to,
right, they're going to do Halsey.
Mm-hmm.
And then we picked a child who was in the, that we found the site of a child. There was a 9-year-old young man. So we're going to do something around him as well.
That's very exciting. Who wrote this piece?
Well, the piece was written by Jan Short. Jan is in the theater department
here at Morgan.
Right. So Jan, we all did some research. Jan, researched much of the information, and she wrote the script. And so the students are, they're going to become those folks. And the good thing was that I think the students had a pretty good experience because, these were people that they didn't really know that much about either.
Right,
so,
right.
It was kind of intriguing for them as well.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
And there's a second part
Dr.
of the program.
Dr. Newman-Ham.
The second part of the program, several of us will interact with the audience. Aaron, is it just Aaron and I and Diane?
And Doug.
Mm-hmm. And... Minister Sands will talk to people about the cemetery. A lot of young people don't really think that segregation extended to death.
Right.
And that, why was there the need for an African-American cemetery? And one of the things that we did not mention was when the plots were sold to individuals, people were supposed to maintain the plots themselves.
The family members were supposed to.
The family members. And over the years, the people who were supposed to do the maintaining either no longer knew or no longer existed. And so that our history then becomes overgrown, shrouded over with all of these weeds and things, and now we're trying to just recapture this wonderful history. I mean, it's not, when you think about people like John Murphy and Lily Carroll Jackson, they're not just local figures.
No, these are major national figures who changed the course of America.
These are major national figures, and that there is difficulty just visiting their burial place because we haven't been able to maintain that cemetery in an excellent way.
So, I mean, this might be a, maybe not a really silly question, but I'm just curious. I mean, I mean, places like Mount Auburn, as you describe them, Diane Jones, as these are not mere cemeteries; these are burial grounds. I mean, there's a kind of a living spiritual quality to them. And I wonder how you would maybe anybody in this room right now describe your feelings when you walked into that place, if you know, and what it was like for you all to just kind of be there.
Well, there are like multiple levels of feelings. First, just the environment itself, because the cemetery sits on top of a ridge.
It's like a high ground.
Yes, right. And actually, it's like one of the few green places that contributes to the Patuxent River.
Really?
Shed. Yeah, it's on the middle branch.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, so you're up on this ridge. You get a great view of the harbor, and even in its
keep it away from developers.
That's one of our challenges.
Probably love to have it.
Yes.
Yes. Immediate.
Well, they can't be allowed to have this place.
It's an immediate concern.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Diane.
Yeah. And luckily, it's on the historic register now. That happened, I guess, in 2001. It's on the historic register, so they can't have it. But
that's
it would be, you know, you get this great harbor view, and even in its unkeptness, it has this wonderfulness about it because of where it is, because of the, you know, the environment, the spiritualness, you know, the monuments, and the way it's designed, it has windy paths. So there's that level of it. And then once you actually go through it and you discover that, wow, you know, there's Joe Gans, or, you know, there's that level. And then there's the level of interaction when you come across something like the Halsey plot, or, you know, baby land, where there's, you know, flowers or pictures of kids on the, you know, the grave, and then the vault building. So there's like multiple levels of feeling and perception when you're there.
Yeah. People born there who were born slaves and died freedmen.
Yes.
That's pretty powerful.
But also, there are various spots in the midst of, even when it was at its worst, where people did come and maintained their spots in the midst of all of the overgrowth and all of the neglect that was evident everywhere else. So, as Diane has said, it affects you on different levels, but it's certainly a wonderful place. It has a spiritual significance that's easy to pick up.
Aaron?
Yeah, and I was also thinking, just as a historian and as a curator, you know, for me, being a curator, being able to walk into a museum, or better yet, a storage area, and just see all of the stuff that's uncatalogued and unarchived, and to be able to work with all of this information, all of this history that's really undiscovered, was really important to me. So walking into the cemetery for the first time for me was like walking into a museum storage area where you have all of this history that's going undocumented. And I'm just wondering, wow, all of these people have these stories. I mean, you have Carl Murphy, of course, and Lily Carroll Jackson, and their stories aren't being told, but there are thousands upon thousands.
Right. Other stories.
Other stories that are not being told, that we don't even know need to be told, because some of the graves are unmarked. And so that's important to me as a cultural historian.
Before we have to move on to the next segment of this program, I wanted to let you all have a final comment, and also get another last caller in here at 410-319-8888. And Levon in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Second show. My mother and my grandmother are buried out there. And at one time, maybe about no more than 7 years ago, Mike Tyson, in his heyday, he was trying to do something to kind of clean the area up. And things fell through, I guess, also with his finances, and that wasn't done. And also, there's a guy, Julius Knob, I believe his name is.
Yes.
I think he's famous. He's on the stamp. He is out there. I wanted to know what was the date that the last person was buried? And are people still being buried out there?
Only those burials are taking place with people who already owned a site of land. And I've been with the board now 2 years. I think we may have had two or three burials during that time.
Huh. Well, let's before we have to go, I want you to kind of once again let our listeners know when we're going to put this up on our website and make sure people know what's going on and what's happening Saturday, what time and people get there.
Well, the performance will begin at 3 o'clock in the cemetery on Waterview Avenue. And the performances should only last maybe about an hour. And then after the performances, we will convene across the street to Westport Academy, where we will talk with the community. We're inviting everyone who comes in to come to the academy and have a dialogue with the historians and with Reverend Sands and Reverend Hinton, and we'll do that for about another hour.
So is there a website, telephone number, a place people can call if they want to be involved?
There's a phone number, and the phone number is 443-885-3422 or 3030.
And we'll put that on our website, and we will have you back on. What I'd like to do is maybe come out with some of you and our recorders and just take a walk and talk and feel it and bring that feeling back to our listeners so they can to continue this, because I think it's vitally important to bring Mount Auburn back to life. No pun intended. I mean that in all sincerity, bring it back to life. So I want to thank Reverend Doug Sands.
Thank you.
Your friend to have in the studio here. And Dr. Deborah Newman Hamm, pleasure to meet you. Good to have you in the studio.
Thank you.
Diane Jones, lovely to meet you. Glad you joined us here today. And Aaron Bryan, always a pleasure to have you.
Yeah, thanks, Mark.
In the studio. And Robin Howard, good to see you again. And
thank you.
Thank you for doing what you're doing. Morgan State University and all of you together for trying to keep Mount Auburn the way it needs to be kept. Thank you so much. We're going to take a very short break. When we come back, we're going to talk about the United States Congress, the money that the health industry pours into that Congress, and how it might be affecting the legislation that affects the future of our lives in terms of health care and health care legislation. Stay with us. We'll be right back. You'll meet David Donnelly and Mike Dennison from Montana. And we'll find out what about the article he wrote. They talked about Max Baucus and what was and who's giving money to his campaign coffers. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and Urbanite Radio stories on The Mark Steiner Show are made possible by Baltimore Mediation, the first mediation firm in the state of Maryland specializing in separation and divorce and business and workplace conflicts, located in Baltimore, and you can contact them at www.baltimoremediation.com. We're going to talk about a really interesting article that we discovered in the Montana newspapers, written by Mike Dennison, who is reporter for the lead newspaper's Montana State Bureau and writes for four daily newspapers in Montana, including the Billings Gazette, about how one-fourth of Senator Max Baucus's campaign contributions came from the health care industry. And, of course, he's the leader of the U.S. Senate Finance Committee that's taking the lead on health care reform legislation. Mike Dennison joins us by phone from Montana. And David Donnelly joins us by phone, who's National Campaign Director for the Public Campaign Action Fund. And Mike Dennison and David Donnelly, welcome. Good to have you both with us.
Thanks. My pleasure.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Now, that first voice was David Donnelly, I take it, right?
This is Mike here.
That's Mike, and David Donnelly was the second voice then.
Yes, it was. Yeah.
Since I can't see him, make sure I have my voices straight. 410-319-8888 is the number here. 410-319-8888. Let me just turn first to Mike Dennison. I think that many people on the East Coast and who are not living in Montana were not aware of this piece. And I know you were also on Democracy Now!, which airs in the station this morning. Is that correct?
That's right. Yes.
Yeah. So talk a bit about what you discovered here, about one-fourth, as you write it, of every dime raised by Baucus and his political action committee have come from groups and individuals associated with drug companies, insurers, hospitals, supply firms, and et cetera, that you wrote about.
That's right. And this is information that's readily available to anyone in the public. You go to this website that's run by the Center for Responsive Politics called OpenSecrets.org, and they have this all down there. We looked at several senators, and we expected to find something like this, maybe not quite in this magnitude, but what's happened is that Baucus is, of course, from Montana, the chair of the Senate Finance Committee, and health interests and insurance interests know he's going to be writing this bill that's coming out in the next week or so. He's been working on it for months, so they've just been pouring money into his campaign, and they're doing the same to other people on the Finance Committee as well. Baucus just happens to be the chair, and he was also up for re-election last year, And so he was the, you know, the top recipient of this money. We're talking about $3.5 million out of $15 million that he raised for his campaign and his leadership PAC, which is a separate political action committee that accepts donations and hands out the money to other candidates around the country.
So what has been the reaction to this? First of all, just locally, I'm curious for what's going on in Montana. What's been the reaction to this article in your own home state?
Well, I think it's kind of been two reactions. I mean, some people are just going, oh, my God, look at this. Look how much money this guy's getting. How can he really be acting on our behalf? And then the other reaction is kind of a cynical reaction, just saying, well, this is kind of what we expected. But I was at a series of meetings across the state about 3 weeks ago at some of these meetings that his staff was holding to talk about the health care reform bill. And the meetings that I went to, most of the people there were, I wouldn't say they're angry, but they're saying, look, we want some reform that's good. And at each of the meetings that I went to, they brought up the subject, hey, look at all the money this guy's getting from the pharmaceutical industry, the healthcare industry, the insurance industry. So I think it's something that people hear about and see about a lot. It's not a big surprise.
It's not a big surprise, but Mike Dennison, David Donnelly, who's with the Public Campaign Action Fund, I think that it's interesting. I was thinking this. I was reading the article and was reading some of the reactions in Montana, and then that it might take a groundswell in a small, more intimate state like Montana, intimate in the sense that there are fewer people in Congress and people have know their congressmen and senators in a way that maybe people in larger states like New York and California and even Maryland do not, to cause some kind of discussion we're not having anywhere else.
Well, I tell you, members of Congress are really caught between two different kinds of constituents when they look at an issue like health care. They look at their constituents back home in their districts in their home states who are suffering or worried about losing their health care because they're not sure they're going to keep their job or their employer may not be able to continue to afford to provide it, or they're out of work. And so those constituents are worried about the quality of their health care and the access to health care. On the other hand, members of Congress are worried about their cash constituents, those that finance their campaigns. And for those in the U.S. Congress, that's every single one of them that's running every 2 years. Even if they're not in competitive races where they have to raise a lot of money to win their own reelection, they have to raise it to pay dues to the party and to help out other members of Congress to increase their party's power. And in the Senate, it's one out of every three senator is up for reelection every 2 years. But these Senate races are getting incredibly expensive. Even in a state like Montana, as you mentioned, that these candidates are raising $6 to $8 to $10 million. And when you think about the amount of time they have to spend with those cash constituents to raise the money, it's inevitable, it's human nature, that they're going to have to listen to those points of view over and over and over again. So members of Congress are caught between these two different poles, their real constituents back home and their cash constituents that they spend an inordinate amount of time trying to attract their interest.
And it's interesting, when one of the people you interviewed, Mike Dennison, for this article, who is Dave Donnelly, who's on our show right now, said just that in your article. And I wonder, I'm curious about what happens to these meetings across the state of Montana. Max Baucus is now famous for saying that no way, no how are we even going to discuss single-payer health care in America.
Yeah, and at these meetings, the meetings that I went to two of them, and all the ones that I saw coverage of, people who wanted a single-payer system were in the majority, were saying, what's going on? You should consider this. So I think that it's a political calculation that Senator Baucus and President Obama have made, that they don't think that's a political possibility, so they're just taking it off the table. And, I guess that's a decision that they've made, and I can't really question that
Yeah, but I'm wondering, as you look at these town meetings taking place across Montana, and you know your constituents and your readers, are we talking about people in audiences saying this stuff who are like single-payer advocates and activists? We're talking about regular citizens.
I'd say probably a little of both. And there's a strong current of populism running through Montana, and there's also a lot of people who have been advocating, or, you know, activists, health reform activists, who say single payer is the way to go. I think that probably the vast, not the vast, but the majority of the public probably doesn't really know what a single payer system is, or just how it would work. I think what these people who are saying this is the way we need to go, they need to educate people on just what it is, because there's a lot of propaganda out there saying it's terrible, it'll never work, it's, you know, it's socialism, that sort of thing.
Now, David Donnelly, the one of the things in this article was that Mike Dennison wrote about was that Senator Charles Grassley of Iowa, a Republican, who's the ranking member of the Republican, ranking Republican on this committee, in the Finance Committee, to make these decisions, also had a huge amount of money, close to 23%, 25, was it 24% of his money?
Yeah, 23.5%.
That was raised from the healthcare industry. So here we have the two men who are going to running the show, maybe coming together to help lead their parties in designing this legislation. Being funded in large part by the healthcare industry. And I wonder how you think that's going to affect the outcome. In other words, congressmen, as they have made can make an argument, oh, we have gone against the healthcare industry before in some of our legislation. But what is universally true at the moment is that all these stakeholders who are putting money into these campaigns are very fearful of either a single-payer system or of some kind of publicly insured system that even the president is talking about wanting to be in competition with private systems as some people to keep them honest. So this is it makes you question where we're going to go with this.
I think that word is a very important word, that word question. I think people around the country are questioning the objectivity of our elected officials to look at this crisis and come up with a solution that works for the most number of people. They are questioning, people around the country are questioning Senator Grassley and Senator Baucus and a variety of their other elected officials on whether or not health care will work for them or whether it'll work for those that fund their campaigns. So those are largely two different sets of people. And in the history of looking at major legislation like this through Congress, not just on health care, but on issue after issue, is that Americans see the special interest getting what they want and the rest of us getting shut out. Now, there was an election in 2008 where there were huge hopes and desires for change. And the mantra of shaking up Washington and changing the way that Washington works was a promise made by the president and anyone who campaigned with him. And so I think what Americans are about to see in this fight is that first test, that first major test, when Senator Grassley and Senator Baucus release this legislation. And we already are very skeptical because of this money. We have lost a little bit of trust that these are honest brokers. Now, these I think lots of people say these are honorable men in a profession that should be seen as more honorable, but it's not because of the role of money in politics. And so what we have here is a campaign finance system that completely taints whether or not we can trust legislation on these kinds of major legislative matters. It's just a travesty. We need to, also address that elephant in the room, which is the time and the influence of the time spent raising the money and the influence that it comes with, particularly as it hurts public opinion.
The lines open here at 410-319-8888. I'll write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. We were inspired to the show by an article that Mike Dennison wrote in the Montana newspapers. He is a reporter for Lee Newspapers, Montana State Bureau, and writes for the four daily papers in Montana, including the Billings Gazette. It was an article about how one quarter of all the funds that Senator Max Baucus gets, who's going to design lead the design of our health care reform, is being paid by the healthcare industry. David Donnelly was quoted in the article, and he's National Campaigns Director of Public Campaign Action Fund, 410-319-8888, as we talk about money in politics. And this, to me, came on the heels also of a recent comment from a senator talking about how we couldn't have the banking reform legislation we want because we are owned lock, stock, and barrel by the banking industry. I mean, the power of money in politics People do, as you were saying, Mike Dennison, citizens go, oh, this is where politics is played. This is how it is. This is how it plays out. But I think that articles like yours begin to lay it on the table in a way that people don't see every day.
Yeah, and what you asked before when you asked David about what we can expect from the reform legislation, I think we're already have already seen that what we can expect is something that is pretty friendly to industry. And I think that the Senate Finance Committee has a reputation of being one that tends to listen to industry. And, you know, it regulates banks and healthcare, a lot of stuff that goes through that committee. So we're going to have an epic battle here between maybe this more moderate and corporate-friendly version of healthcare reform that the Senate Finance Committee may want and the Senate may want versus what the president wants. And even what the president wants, a lot of people think it's not that good of a deal. It's just putting a lot of bureaucratic stuff on top of an already fragmented system.
And
well,
did
I'm
you
not real hopeful.
I think that's part of the problem, I think, that David Donnelly, that American people almost kind of give up on this.
Well, I tell you, that senator you mentioned who said that the
yes.
banks own the place is Senator Dick Durbin.
That was what Dick, I couldn't remember. Dick Durbin,
yeah,
right, Chicago.
And you know, I work on the issue of money politics day in, day out, and advocate for a public financing bill that Senator Durbin has introduced called the Fair Elections Now Act. And, you know, he was very upset at the banks when they defeated a bill of his, switching 12 Democratic votes against him, and he came out literally on the floor of the Senate saying they frankly own the place, which is an amazing statement of someone actually the second leading senator in the U.S. Senate. But we see this on issue after issue, and on this health care issue, yeah, it goes through the Finance Committee, which is known as a money committee. And why is it known as a money committee? It's not because they deal with a lot of tax issues and whatnot. It's known as a money committee because that's a committee you go to when you can raise a whole lot of money for your reelection as well as for your party and for your party's candidates. And that's, you know, there's a, you know, always the major legislation goes through that committee, and that's where a lot of money goes to those members.
So I wonder if you could, Mike Dennison, kind of outline for us where this money came from. Who's giving this money?
Yeah, certainly. This the money that I wrote about, the 23%, it is coming from people and political action committees who are connected with health care and insurance. And so we're talking about people who work for pharmaceutical companies, people who work for health insurance companies, medical supply companies, hospitals, HMOs, health service companies, and physicians themselves. And it is possible that some of this money is coming from people who would want reforms that are much more, I won't say radical, but certainly more less corporate than the ones that we're seeing. But I think that we can probably say the majority of it is coming from people who work for large corporations that have a huge financial stake in the outcome of this reform legislation.
Has there been any cry politically from other elected officials about this? You wrote that Senator John Tester has a minimal contribution from health and insurance sectors. Have they had anything to say about this at all?
Not really. In fact, we thought it was notable when we asked Senator Tester, our other Democratic senator from Montana, where do you stand on the public option health insurance that's being proposed? It's going to be a big fight over. And even he, who's gotten basically no money from these guys, was very reluctant to kind of stake out a position on that particular issue. So we really haven't heard anyone raising any concerns except citizens and people like Mr. Donnelly talking about this. And he also mentioned that the Senate Finance Committee is like kind of the center of money, which is correct. As you look at some of the other senators who are involved in the debate, even ones like your own senator from Maryland there, Senator Mikulski, who's on the Senate Health Committee, she only got like maybe 5% of her money from these interests. So the Finance Committee really is the receptacle of a whole pile of this money.
That's very interesting. I did not look up our own. But you inspired me to want to do that. So I'm just curious. You're saying that she did not receive that money. Did you look up
5%?
Did you look up Ben Cardin?
Yeah, he also got about the same amount out of about $10 million that he raised in the same period. I'd say about $1 million. I'm sorry, I misstated that. Anyway, about 5% of his money also came from the same interests, and he's not sitting on any of these key committees that have to do with the health care reform.
And it should be noted, I actually because I. Like Mike, I knew I was coming on a radio show in Maryland. I looked up the positions that these two Maryland senators have taken on the health care issue, and both of them have come out for the public option that the president supports and other members of Congress support. It is interesting to take a look at these issues and match them from between their money from the industries and their positions or their votes. There's a great website called maplight.org, and that site, as soon as a vote in Congress is cast on a major issue, they will put that roll call up on their site and show in the second column how much money did the member of Congress take from an affected industry.
Oh, really? What's it called? Map?
Maplight.org.
Well, that's a new one on me, too. I don't know that one.
And it's, they don't do it on every issue because they just simply can't, and, it's a significant amount of work to do it. But a lot of it is automated, and they'll do it on some of the major issues of the day, and they'll try to show the correlation. Now, there's just not a big correlation. Someone who has been in Congress for 35 years and, has run for office, 16 times or 18 times, may have raised a significant amount of money from these industries simply because they've had a number of electoral contests, and it adds up over the years. But a lot of the time, unfortunately, there is a correlation, and it raises a question for the public: who are these people representing? You can often go against the wishes of your constituents if you're able to raise a lot of money because your opponents don't have a chance to run on a level playing field.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't have a chance to get their message out. And we're going to see this play out, I think, over the next year, not just in terms of the policy, but the political fallout from these battles will reverberate in the 2010 elections. The voters will make a decision: did Congress do right by us?
And I think part of it has to do with the kind of work the media does, especially people like Mike, like you're doing, which is to expose us for local readers to see what their congressional representatives are doing and where their money's coming from is a very important thing, not taking a position, but a very important thing for voters to know.
Yeah, I would agree. And also one thing that David mentioned about the elections, I think it's notable that Senator Baucus, he just ran for re-election last year in Montana,
right,
and he basically had no opposition. He had a token Republican who ran against him. Wasn't even supported by the Republican Party. He's just kind of a political gadfly. So here he is running with no opposition, and he still raises almost $12 million for his campaign, which is a huge amount of money in Montana. I think there's two factors. One, the fact that all these groups that want to influence what he does in the Finance Committee, and second, he piles up so much money that no one wants to run against him because they know they're going to get creamed.
Well, I'm going to say that everything we've talked about here, the new website, Center for Responsive Politics, if you learned about it, maplight.org, will be on our website, as well as a link to David Donnelly's Public Campaign Action Fund and to Mike Dennison's articles in Montana. I'm going to thank you, Mike Dennison, for doing the work you do, and David Donnelly, both the work you do, and thank you so much for joining us in this part of our program. It's been a pleasure to talk to you both.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Mark.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Thank you both very much. And all those pieces will be on our website. You can go up to see those. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite, Baltimore's free monthly magazine of ideas and innovation. This month, Urbanite gets on board our transportation future with stories about how electric cars could change the city, the battle for streets between drivers and bicyclists, and the possible second act for the great American streetcar. Urbanite is available at over 700 locations around the region and online at UrbaniteBaltimore.com. You can hear that streetcar battle tomorrow here on The Mark Steiner Show, which is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Jessica Phillips. We're engineered by Zachary Coleman. Our interns are Judith Lloyd and Brian Boone. Theme music by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again and podcast any of our past shows and hear additional interviews, visit us on the web at SteinerShow.org. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM. The voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by MECU, Baltimore's credit union, and the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development.